We open tonight a new chapter in the synthesis of yoga, the section, the yoga of divine works. This is the 12th chapter. In the Arya, it appeared in 1915 on the 15th of November. Of course, when Sri Aurobindo took up this first section of the larger body of what was the synthesis of yoga, he gave them each section a different title: Yoga of Divine Works, Yoga of Divine Knowledge, Yoga of Divine Love, and the Yoga of Self-Perfection. This is the section that he had more time to revise, and he began a thorough revision in around 1932. He had done some light work in the 20s, and then took up some of what he had revised in 1932 again in the early 40s and added to it. So this chapter too, like many that have preceded, has been substantially rewritten, although it's still recognizable. Go back to the, I guess, second volume of the Aryam, and you'll find it in that year. Chapter 12, The Divine Work. One question remains for the seeker upon the way of works, when his quest is or seems to have come to its natural end: whether any work or what work is left for the soul after liberation, and to what purpose. Equality has been seated in the nature, or governs the whole nature. There has been achieved a radical deliverance from the ego idea, from the pervading ego sense, from all feelings and impulsions of the ego and its self-will and desires. The entire self-consecration has been made not only in thought and heart, but in all the complexities of the being. A complete purity or transcendence of the three gunas has been harmoniously established. The soul has seen the master of its works and lives in his presence, or is consciously contained in his being, or is unified with him, or feels him in the heart or above, and obeys his dictates. It has known its true being and cast away the veil of the ignorance. What work then remains for the worker in man, and with what motive, to what end, in what spirit will it be done? So the context is interesting because it summons to us the figure of an integral aspirant who has achieved great things already in yoga. He has established in himself samatha, the equality that governs the whole nature. He's got rid of the fictional ego because he knows that his spiritual essence is a thing born from beyond time, born from the Supreme Person itself, and is not subject to the velleities of mutable nature, because he has been able to still his consciousness and find out the reality of himself at soul depth. He knows that the secret of work is self-giving, an absolute self-consecration, a making sacred of one's own being, and all one thinks and perceives and undertakes is done for that, not for the ego. And all the fruit of all the work is offered, not begrudgingly, spontaneously, joyfully. So if knowing your soul and living in communion with the Supreme is your situation, then is there more to do? What would bid you forth? Well, Sri Aurobindo doesn't bring them up immediately, but of course, there's one of the earliest phrases of the Gita, Karmasu Kaushalam, yoga is skill in works. And then, not by abstention, not by sannyasa, does the aspirant get the fulfillment, siddhi. So these Sri Aurobindo leaves aside, but it's clear that the early teaching of the Gita and the teaching of self-consecration, all of this presumes that the seeker has come to some state of enlightenment. And now, why would you continue to work? The next section begins. There is one answer with which we are very familiar in India. No work at all remains, for the rest is quiescence. When the soul can live in the eternal presence of the Supreme, or when it is unified with the Absolute, the object of our existence in the world, if it can be said to have an object, at once ceases. Man, released from the curse of self-division and the curse of ignorance, is released too from that other affliction, the curse of works. All action would then be a derogation from the supreme state and a return into the ignorance. So immediately we see an opposition between what the greater teaching of India has been into ages immemorial and what became a primary impulse from the influence of traditions that were based on Shramana, on the renunciation, on the throwing away of the world and its values. In other words, we have here Bhagavad Gita versus Buddhism. He is going to discuss in this first section, what are the motives? Action as a derogation from the supreme state, a return to ignorance. To derogate means to reduce, it means to repeal part of a law, derogare from the Latin. So action is a lessening of your divine state in the realm of the Shramanas. This attitude towards life, he writes, is supported by an idea founded on the error of the vital nature to which action is dictated only by one or all of three inferior motives: necessity, restless instinct, and impulse or desire. And for the last, you could go to the Gita 3:36. The instinct or impulse, quiescent, desire extinguished, what place is there for works? Some mechanical necessity might remain, but no other, and even that would cease forever with the fall of the body. And this has been current even to the last couple of decades in teachings of great spiritual figures that if I have realized the self, then I'll just let the body atrophy and fall away according to its merits or demerits. The battery will wind down and the body will expire, but my spirit, being immortal, persists. I continue because I am one with the capital self. What care I for this carriage of flesh? But the Gita has a different view. But after all, even so, while life remains, action is unavoidable. Mere thinking, or in the absence of thought, mere living, is itself an act and a cause of many effects. All existence in the world is work, force, potency, and has a dynamic effect in the whole by its mere presence. Even the inertia of the clod, even the silence of the immobile Buddha on the verge of nirvana. So this again goes back to the Gita, the third chapter, the fifth shloka in Sri Aurobindo's rendering. For none stands, even for a moment, not doing works. Everyone is made to do action helplessly by the modes born of Prakriti. So whatever is here, if you feel compassion for the world, if you have an eye towards eliminating or reducing its suffering, know that even if you quit acting, the very fact of occupying a body is a work itself. And draining away the intent, the direction, the purpose, the motivation of the work to something that renounces and cancels out existence has a negativing effect upon the whole. Sri Aurobindo doesn't write it here, but that's what it means. There is a cost in action because thick and tangled is the way of works. We'll make errors. We have to grow to know. We have to live in the soul. And until we do, our action will be imperfect. But even when we achieve soul awareness, action is not automatically perfect. Still, one stumbles. But the cost of passivity is measureless, because you abandon the world and it cannot change. If its best instruments, its most conscious agents, refuse to interact, refuse to engage. There is the question only of the manner of the action, the instruments that are used or that act of themselves, and the spirit and knowledge of the worker. For in reality, no man works, but nature works through him for the self-expression of a power within that proceeds from the infinite. To know that, and live in the presence and in the being of the master of nature, free from desire and the illusion of personal impulsion, is the one thing needful. The Gita in the third chapter, 22nd shloka says, I have nothing to gain, but I work. This is the Supreme speaking to Arjuna through the form of Krishna. And also, the fourth chapter of the Gita, works fix not themselves on me. So the divine is always at peace, always engaged in the world processes. The functioning of the universe is engineered by the divine will. What drives each individual forward in his or her personal evolution is shepherded, indeed inhabited, by a divine direction embedded inside, which is the seed of the divine's own being. Back to Sri Aurobindo. That, and not the bodily cessation of action, is the true release. For the bondage of works at once ceases. A man might sit still and motionless forever, and yet be as much bound to the ignorance as the animal or the insect. But if he can make this greater consciousness dynamic within him, then all the work of all the worlds could pass through him, and yet he would remain at rest, absolute in calm and peace, free from all bondage. Action in the world is given us first as a means for our self-development and self-fulfillment. But even if we reached the last possible divine self-completeness, it would still remain as a means for the fulfillment of the divine intention in the world and of the larger universal self of which each being is a portion that has come down with it from the transcendence. So yes, first we undertake it, even through our egoistic motivations, to achieve and develop for ourselves, and later the adventure, the joy of the soul in its growth into consciousness, into power. But then, as the Gita says elsewhere, we do the work for Loka Sangraha, for the holding together of the peoples, or for the holding together of the world. There is a cosmic purpose to be attained, and he who has finished with this personal development may be initiated into something more large. And that discovery of ourselves, the jiva, born from the nature of the Supreme, endowed with the powers of the Supreme Nature, is what we really are. And that has accompanied us into the coils of the cosmos, and we are really given a new life when we discover that and live from that. We introduce a new life to the cosmos. New possibilities are born. New frontiers of consciousness can be explored. There lies the diminution of suffering. There lies the revelation of joy and delight. Live from the soul and grow the cosmos. So here too, he's brought again into focus the individual living in consonance, communality with the universe as an expression of transcendence, the three terms of being. But the individual is not the ego. The individual is the jiva, the recovered sense of the jiva. In a certain sense, when his yoga has reached a certain culmination, works cease for a man. For he has no further personal necessity of works, no sense of works being done by him. But there is no need to flee from action or to take refuge in a blissful inertia. For now, he acts as the divine existence acts, without any binding necessity and without any compelling ignorance. This is echoed in the Upanishads earlier than the Gita, where we're invited to live in communion with Brahman and in a sense be co-creators of the cosmos. Join with, ride with, do my works in the world. Even in doing works, he does not work at all. He undertakes no personal initiative. It is the divine Shakti that works in him through his nature. His action develops through the spontaneity of a supreme force by which his instruments are possessed, of which he is a part, with whose will his will is identical, and his power is her power. Works in him through his nature. And the Gita, giving up works to me, then I effect through you. The Spirit within him contains, supports, and watches this action. It presides over it in knowledge, but is not glued or clamped to the work by attachment or need, is not bound by desire of its fruit, is not enslaved to any movement or impulse. Gita again, chapter 5, verse 12. The soul, by abandoning attachment, attains to peace. It is a common error to suppose that action is impossible or at least meaningless without desire. If desire ceases, we are told, action also must cease. But this, like other too simply comprehensive generalizations, is more attractive to the cutting and defining mind than true. The major part of the work done in the universe is accomplished without any interference of desire. It proceeds by the calm necessity and spontaneous law of nature. This too, Gita chapter 5, verse 14, nature works out these things, Krishna tells Arjuna. And let's read another sentence or two. Even man constantly does works of various kinds by a spontaneous impulse, intuition, instinct, or acts in obedience to a natural necessity and law of forces without either mental planning or the urge of a conscious, vital, volition, or emotional desire. This is consonant with all the discoveries of modern phenomenology, the study of neurology, evolutionary biology. All of these different fields point to what brain science offers us, that we think we decide to do something with our conscious mind. We make a decision, and by golly, we go and do it. No, you can actually track the activity of the various parts of our physical apparatus and see that the impulse originates from what you can call the vital mind, an appetite that's within us, and stimulates the mind to find a reason to undertake action that's consonant with the desire. And then we go forward. So the conscious mind finds a reason to support and rationalize a vital motivation. That's how it actually works. It is a yogin who can stand back and see the entirety of the nature, the physical, the vital, the mental, who has the capacity to stand away and become sovereign of the being, re-enter it, and say, this you shall do from a higher motivation. It is the yogin who may be free of nature, and the rest of us are actually rather well and rather thoroughly determined by the nature that we think we direct. So, again, often enough his act is contrary to his intention or his desire. It proceeds out of him in subjection to a need or compulsion, in submission to an impulse, in obedience to a force in him that pushes for self-expression, or in conscious pursuance of a higher principle. Desire is an additional lure to which nature has given a great part in the life of animated beings in order to produce a certain kind of rajasic action necessary for her intermediate ends. So intermediate between the physical at the base and between the mental at the top. Something has to get us going, and desire pushes us. Socrates had a certain view of this, but we won't drift away into Platonic dialogues. It has its great use while it endures. It helps us to rise out of inertia. It contradicts many tamasic forces which would otherwise inhibit action. But the seeker, who has advanced far on the way of works, has passed beyond this intermediate stage in which desire is a helpful engine. Its push is no longer indispensable for his action, but is rather a terrible hindrance and source of stumbling, inefficiency, and failure. Others are obliged to obey a personal choice or motive, but he has to learn to act with an impersonal or a universal mind, or as a part or an instrument of an infinite person. All these are different stages of spiritual enlightenment. A different superior consciousness to the natural is implied in each one of those. A calm indifference, a joyful impartiality, or a blissful response to a divine force, whatever its dictate, is the condition of his doing any effective work or undertaking any worthwhile action. And that again from the Gita, chapter 4, the 20th shloka. Having abandoned all attachments to the fruit of his works, ever satisfied without any kind of dependence, he does nothing, though he engages in action. Back to Sri Aurobindo. Not desire, not attachment must drive him, but a will that stirs in a divine peace, a knowledge that moves from the transcendent light, a glad impulse that is a force from the supreme Ananda. So where is it that housed in peace, knowledge, will, and delight coexist? This is that higher world, of which our world is a disguised manifestation, but he was referring to the supramental manifestation of realities that exist eternally in Satchit-Ananda. So we can live by a will's action in us, an adesh, liberated into self-knowledge, one with the supreme will, and divinely inspired to work and move on this globe, not in the higher world, not in the supraphysical, but here and now, ihaiva, in this place. That is the challenge for the integral yogin. So I think that's a good place to put a pause for the evening. We'll continue next time. And I have, if you'll grant me the opportunity, I'll read some section from Savitri again. This is going to be from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, The Yoga of the King, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. We'll start on page 23. A spirit that is a flame of God abides, a fiery portion of the wonderful. Artist of his own beauty and delight, immortal in our mortal poverty. This sculptor of the forms of the infinite, this screened unrecognized inhabitant, initiate of his own veiled mysteries, hides in a small dumb seed his cosmic thought. In the mute strength of the occult idea, determining predestined shape and act, passenger from life to life, from scale to scale, changing his imaged self from form to form. He regards the icon growing by his gaze, and in the worm foresees the coming God. At last the traveler in the paths of time arrives on the frontiers of eternity. In the transient symbol of humanity draped, he feels his substance of undying self and loses his kinship to mortality. A beam of the eternal smites his heart. His thought stretches into infinitude. All in him turns to spirit vastnesses. His soul breaks out to join the oversoul. His life is oceaned by that super life. He has drunk from the breasts of the mother of the worlds. A topless supernature fills his frame. She adopts his spirit's everlasting ground as the security of her changing world and shapes the figure of her unborn mites. Immortally, she conceives herself in him, in the creature, the unveiled creatrix works. Her face is seen through his face, her eyes through his eyes. Her being is his through a vast identity. Then is revealed in man the overt divine. A static oneness and dynamic power descend in him, the integral Godhead seals. His soul and body take that splendid stamp. A long, dim preparation is man's life, a circle of toil and hope and war and peace, tracked out by life on matter's obscure ground. In his climb to a peak no feet have ever trod, he seeks through a penumbra shot with flame, a veiled reality half known, ever missed, a search for something or someone never found, cult of an ideal never made real here, an endless spiral of ascent and fall, until at last is reached the giant point through which his glory shines for whom we were made, and we break into the infinity of God. Across our nature's borderline, we escape into supernature's arc of living light. This now was witnessed in that Son of Force. In him that high transition laid its base. Original and supernal immanence, of which all nature's process is the art. The cosmic worker set his secret hand to turn this frail mud engine to heaven use. A presence wrought behind the ambiguous screen. It beat his soil to bear a titan's weight, refining half-hewn blocks of natural strength. It built his soul into a statued god. The craftsman of the magic stuff of self, who labors at his high and difficult plan in the wide workshop of the wonderful world, modeled in inward time his rhythmic parts. Then came the abrupt transcendent miracle. The masked, immaculate grandeur could outline, at travail in the occult womb of life, his dreamed magnificence of things to be, a crown of the architecture of the worlds, a mystery of married earth and heaven, annexed divinity to the mortal scheme. A seer was born, a shining guest of time. For him, mind's limiting firmament seized above. In the griffin forefront of the night and day, a gap was rent in the all-concealing vault. The conscious ends of being went rolling back. The landmarks of the little person fell. The island ego joined its continent. Overpassed was this world of rigid limiting forms. Life's barriers opened into the unknown. Abolished were conception's covenants, and striking off subjection's rigorous claws, annulled the soul's treaty with nature's nescience. All the gray inhibitions were torn off, and broken the intellect's hard and lustrous lid. Truth unpartitioned found immense sky room. An empyrean vision saw and knew. The bounded mind became a boundless light. The finite self mated with infinity. His march now soared into an eagle's flight. Out of apprenticeship to ignorance, wisdom upraised him to her mastercraft and made him an archmason of the soul, a builder of the immortal's secret house, an aspirant to supernal timelessness. Freedom and empire called to him from on high. Above mind's twilight and life's star-led night, there gleamed the dawn of a spiritual day. Namaste, Jai Ma.